Evergreen Sermons Online and Pastor Michael Gabbert's Wednesday night series reviewing our weekly Bible readings. This message is from September 2nd, 2015.
I appreciate you being here. I told you a week ago that tonight this would be a hopping place. Our Awana kicks off tonight. We've got a couple of discipleship courses, financial management class, and some other things that are taking place around our campus. So there's a lot of activity. And I appreciate you making this a part of your schedule for this week. We began a series last Wednesday night on Revelation. I've entitled it, Everything Made Right. Some of you may recall, I taught through the book of Revelation in 2009. Now, it may surprise you because you think, well, you just did that. But it was actually 6 years ago. And I entitled that series, New Beginnings. And I've looked back at that over the years, and as I prepared to take us through Revelation in 2015, I really think that was a wrong title. And that's why I've gone with the idea of everything made right. Because there is a sense in which Revelation tells us how things come to a conclusion and eternity begins. But really, eternity is not fundamentally different from this. It is the redeemed version of this. And so there is a sense of new beginning, but really it's a better description to describe the book of Revelation as telling us about the sequence of events that take place that eventually bring us to the moment that we have yearned for. There is something in the human spirit that knows that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And even those who claim to be atheists or agnostics, even those who are hostile to the church, they still use the language of eternal ethics. They say, this is not right. This is not fair. It shouldn't be this way. We should do this. We ought to do that. That is not the language of Darwinian evolution. The worldview of secular humanism is based on an evolutionary mindset which ought to have about it a sense that I really don't give a flying rip what happens to you. I'm only in this to extend my contribution to the gene pool. There's no place in evolutionary philosophy for morality or this sort of innate sense that I'm dissatisfied with the world because it's not supposed to be like this. That comes from the fact that whether you acknowledge God or not, part of what it means to be a creature made in the image of God is that we have inherent in our nature an understanding that it wasn't always like this. Something happened and we lost innocence. And we can't stand the thought that it will remain like this forever without some hope that eventually things are made right. We talk about instances where people die before we can get justice. There is something inside of us that says there must be a place where justice is satisfied. We can't make sense of existence without it. So, the name of the series as we go through Revelation this time is Everything Made Right. And I think it gives us a slight shift in the way that we walk through this material, because what we're seeing is a revelation of a series of visions that God gave to the Apostle John as the recorder on our behalf, the recorder of the visions. He was told to write what you see, to record these visions. John did the best he could. He exhausted his human vocabulary to try and put on a writing surface things that are, in a sense, truly indescribable. But as we walk through this, we're going to talk about a lot of different things, from the rapture, which, frankly, is not explicitly in the book of Revelation, to the millennium, which is something barely hinted at in the book of Revelation, to the unfolding wrath of God on a world in that last judgment before evil is finally put in its place. And as we talk through all of these things, whether it's a vision of a worship scene in heaven, or whether it's a battle in the heavenlies, or whether it's a series of natural disasters on earth, if we approach this book with the idea that this is the process of finally making things right, I think it'll give us the perspective that we need to make our way through. I started last week with what I called an introduction to interpretation. And we talked about the paradigms that you use to go through the book of Revelation. And I talked about millennial positions and tribulational positions and things like that. I really want to I want to continue the introduction tonight with what I've called historical context. And we did the first three verses last week. We'll do five verses today. And then we'll get more into the text and unfold it in the weeks ahead beginning next Wednesday. But for a study of this length and this depth, 2 weeks of introduction is okay. So deal with it. If you didn't get a handout, there are some available in the back. Let me talk to you about the recipients of this book. I want you to have the... If you need some, just raise your hand. Somebody will jump up if you need any. The recipients of the revelation. In the second and the third chapter, we have seven letters written by Jesus, delivered through John, to seven churches in Asia. Their names are actually recorded in Revelation chapter 1, verse 11. Now, we'll talk next week, we'll talk in 2 weeks, about those churches, because we're actually going to spend either 2 or 3 weeks. I'm having serious allergy problems, and so I'm going to... There's a pastor that used to be given... He had a deacon that would give him a cough drop every Sunday when he'd step into the pulpit. And his instruction was, preach till the cough drop is gone, then quit. That worked great until the Sunday when he reached into his pocket and popped a button into his mouth. And 2.5 hours later, he wondered why the cough drop was still there. So if you'll allow me that. We're going to talk about those churches, but basically, those churches may have been selected for any of a number of reasons, and we'll get to that when we get there, but I want to talk about in general the Christians that were suffering from persecution, that were the original recipients of this book. Now, I talked last week about ways to interpret Revelation, and one of my presuppositions is that while Revelation is about last days, it must have had, like all prophecy, it must have had specific meaning and significance. Oh, thank you. It must have had specific meaning and significance for the first audience. There was no benefit to a persecuted church if John says, hey, I know you're going through the worst time of your life, but I'm going to give you a document that really will be important 2,000 years from now. There had to be significance in their context and in their situation. So let me describe the people that received this letter for the first time, but I want to make a parallel because I want you to see part of the reason I'm teaching through Revelation in 2015 is because I'm convinced that we are closer globally to that first generation and the circumstances surrounding those original recipients, we're maybe closer to that context than at any point in the last 2,000 years. Let me show you what I mean. They suffered persecution for a variety of reasons. First of all, Christianity in the Roman Empire of the first century was an illegal religion. It was illegal because they were not willing to cooperate with the pantheon of religions that were a part of the Roman Empire. Rome had a policy. The official approach toward religion in Rome was they really didn't care what religion you followed. They didn't care what god you prayed to. They were willing, with every conquered nation that was absorbed into the Roman Empire, they took the gods of that nation and they put their images in the hall of gods in Rome, and they were just seen as one of the many options. There's a smorgasbord of gods to choose from. Go for whatever you want. Worship whatever you want. Pray to whoever you want. Christianity wouldn't play that game because they aspired to universality. That is, there was a sense in which Christianity was refused to allow themselves to be just another option on a par with all of the other gods that were collected as the Romans conquered one nation after another. In fact, with the Romans, they really didn't care what your religion was, because for them, the state was the main thing. As long as you had blind support of the state, they didn't care about your religion. Now, you might not have been able to say this 10 years ago, but we are increasingly approaching a culture that says, we don't care what you do in your private time, as long as you bow to the state on all subjects of conscience. I mean, the whole point of suing a bakery owner because they don't want to make a cake for a particular kind of wedding, and the judge in New Mexico, where they had the case with a photographer who didn't want to participate in a same-sex marriage and recommended a different photographer, as he was sued, the judge said this: when you come to the public square, you must put your private beliefs on hold so as not to offend the rest of the society. Folks, that is by definition the opposite of religious liberty. This idea, they've even changed the language. If you'll notice, we have politicians now who don't speak about religious, the freedom of religion. They speak about freedom of worship. So, well, what's the difference? Well, freedom of religion is my freedom to live according to my conscience in all aspects of the belief system that I have committed myself to. Freedom of worship means you can go to church and you can sing whatever songs you want. They're content, as Rome was content, to allow us to have freedom of worship. Go into your temples, go to your churches, go to your synagogues. We don't care what the name of the God is you call on, but when you come out of the doors and back into the public square, it is absolute allegiance to the state that is required. And Christians couldn't do that. They couldn't put themselves in a position where their belief was a subsidiary of the state. I got into a lot of trouble one time, which is not anything new. I got into a lot of trouble one time being in a church where somebody had given money for a flagpole. Well, you know, in a church, when somebody gives money and they designate it for something, you got to do that. We have different rules at Evergreen, by the way. But they gave money for a flagpole, and they wanted to put up a flagpole. Well, here's the problem. Here's my problem with the flagpole. I am as patriotic as the next guy. Man, I mean, part of my battle is a sense that God really has a purpose for the United States of America. I believe in the American experiment. But here's my problem. They wanted to put the American flag at the top of the flagpole, which is appropriate. and they wanted to put the Christian flag under it. Well, legally, that's appropriate. So I'm not going to do that. Communicates the wrong message. And you can't legally put the Christian flag above the American flag. So I said, well, we'll just have an empty flagpole because I'm not putting the Christian flag underneath the American flag. Well, Pastor, you're just splitting hairs. Maybe so. Well, somebody had a brilliant idea. I wish it had been mine, but they found a flagpole topper that had a cross on it. So we put the cross on top of the flagpole, and then we put the American flag. That I could live with. You say, well, you're just being silly. That's just splitting hairs. No, listen. Symbols are powerful things because they communicate our most heartfelt loyalties and convictions. In the first century, Christians couldn't, they couldn't put themselves in a position of swearing their highest loyalty to the emperor. It was not possible. Christianity was an exclusive religion. They couldn't be one of the choices. They couldn't be a combination. They couldn't be a mixture. There was no blending of gods allowed. The very first commandment given to the people of God is, have no other gods before me. It is fundamental and foundational to the very idea. Our God refuses to be one in the crowd. Christians have always paid a price for that. Because see, it's no threat if your God is just one of the boys. But it's a huge threat if there is only one loyalty allowed. Believers were accused of all manner of evils. It was interesting in the first century because of the misunderstanding of Christian theology. There was some suspicion about Christianity because so many of their meetings were held at night, often held in secret. And there were charges made because information would dribble out. Did you know those Christians, they practice incest? I mean, they're always talking about loving the brothers and loving the sisters. You know, they practice cannibalism. They have a ritual where they drink blood and they eat flesh. And in the pagan world of the Roman Empire, there was really no understanding of the symbolism of the church as a family, of this idea of the Last Supper as a picture of the body and blood of Christ. They misunderstood, but the charges were often leveled and Christians were persecuted and even executed on the basis of these kinds of charges. They were an affront to respectable people because they practiced the most obscene kinds of practices. Number five, Christians refused to go to war. It was not that Christians were pacifists in the first century so much. It's just that because the state was all-consuming in its loyalty for the Roman Empire, to serve in the Roman army required first and foremost an oath to the idols of the gods that were the patron saints of the army. Christians wouldn't serve in the army because it involved taking an oath of loyalty to a god that they refused to recognize as real. Secondly, while it would be another 400 years before Christianity would actually begin to articulate a doctrine that would come to be called the just war theory, about four centuries after Rome, Christianity really grappled with this whole issue of warfare. And they determined that based on what's called the just war theory, there are boundaries that must be observed, and war can only be done with certain parameters. There has to be a justness to the cause. There has to be a limitation on the excessiveness of of the treatment of prisoners. I mean, there's a whole theological history of development that will eventually take place. The first century believers didn't have that full-blown theology of a just war theory, but they did understand at a gut level that the primary use of the Roman military was for colonial purposes. They were conquering neighboring nations to expand the boundaries of the empire. And even in the first century, there was a sense that was an unjust cause. And so combined with the oaths that were required, Christians refused to go to war. They were persecuted as a result. They were also chiefly from the poor and the outcast classes. I heard one documentary one time sort of speak about early Christianity with disdain, and they said, well, you know, it was the provenance of the uneducated women and slaves. Well, actually, that's true. It was most appealing to those segments of society. Why? Because the uneducated, the poor, women and slaves, those were the segments of society that had never in their entire lives had a sense of dignity and significance. And the message of the gospel was, I mean, think about these elements that the gospel brings to the table. It starts by saying, you were created in the image of a perfect God. You are marked by a dignity that comes from being His special and unique creation. You are gifted by His presence in you when you come into His kingdom. You are adopted by the King. He gifts you so that He can use you. You have now, for the first time in life, a meaningfulness and a contribution to make that has eternal significance. You matter. And these were the segments of society that in their whole lives had never heard that message. There were 12 disciples that followed Jesus, but there were dozens of women. Why? Because Jesus was the first man in their lives that looked at them and said, you're important. Come sit down here and let me teach you about God. But you look at who those people were, it's easy to see why they were drawn to the gospel. It's easy to see why they were attracted to Jesus, but it's just as easy to see why Christianity would have been disdained by the powers that be in the first century, because its greatest appeal was among the people who were seen to be the least significant in the society. Christians refused to compromise. They were often seen as fanatics. This was the era of casual philosophies and pragmatic convictions. That is, the Romans didn't mind a little religion, but don't let it interfere with the economics of things. You remember one of the scenes in the book of Acts? Paul travels to Ephesus, and there's a little girl that comes to know Christ through Paul's testimony. And there's kind of an uproar. And Ephesus was a trade center for the worship of the goddess Diana or Artemis. And so many people were coming to Christ that the idol makers were taking a real economic hit to their business. I mean, if you believe in an invisible God, guess what you don't need? You don't need an idol. And the idol makers brought charges against Paul, not on theological grounds, but on economic grounds. I don't think they cared that Paul was teaching about this new, what they thought was a Jewish God, but it did bother them that this was hurting them in the pocketbook. And that happened throughout the Roman Empire, and Christians wouldn't compromise on these matters. So they were seen to be a little over the top. Now that's interesting, because the very thing most Christians in the 21st century don't want to be accused of is fanaticism. It's amazing how we want to do religion in a way that doesn't make us really different from everybody else we know. We just want to live on our street, and we want to be just like our neighbors, and we want to drive the same cars, and we want to have the same values, and we want to fit in. Listen, maybe it would help us to get back to a time when Christianity was heavily present among the outcast classes. Because when you're already outcast, fanaticism for Jesus, it doesn't bother you that they think you're kind of weird. We're, frankly, we're too respectable. One of the things we're going to pick up in Revelation is this idea that cultural respectability, frankly, has no place in the life of a serious believer and follower of Jesus Christ. Now, you know, we're not going to start handling snakes and doing weird stuff. I'm just talking about living a life where when we talk to somebody about Jesus, we're more concerned about what Jesus thinks of us than we are about what that person thinks of us. That's a huge mindset shift. And those believers in the first century, guess what? They were already on the outside looking in. They didn't mind being different for Jesus because Jesus had given them meaning and purpose and significance for the first time in their lives. There was nothing, let me put it this way, there was nothing that Rome had to offer that early Christians wanted more than they wanted Jesus. And I have to wonder if we can say that or not. Are there things that our culture offers us that when push comes to shove, we just have to admit we want those things more than we want Jesus? Number 8, Christians refuse to worship the emperor. That's the bottom line of this whole thing. Eventually, as Rome began to suffer from internal collapse, now we know as historians looking back that Rome began to implode because it had become so immoral that the structures of society couldn't sustain themselves. I mean, even if there wasn't a thing called Christianity, Rome still would have fallen because it was rotten at the core. By the end of the first century, and certainly by the third century, Rome was like a tree. We had to cut down a tree one time that was pretty good size, pretty tall. And when they cut it down, the reason we had to cut it down was because it was diseased. And when we cut it down and it fell over down into the stump and deep into the trunk was a huge hole. The tree was going to blow over in a storm because the disease had hollowed it out. It had no substance. It had appearance, but there was no core. That was Rome by the third century. Whether Christianity existed or not, Rome was going to collapse because it had no core. But there was a Christianity. And one of the things about rampant immorality is that rampant immorality in a society, and this is relevant to where we are, rampant immorality in a society is always accompanied by blindness as to the true cause of our problems. And so when society is crumbling around us, it can't be because society is immoral and rotten to the core. It's got to be somebody's fault. Well, in the first century, they decided, particularly by the end of the first century with Emperor Domitian, they decided that those Christians who refuse to worship the emperor are bringing the wrath of the gods on the empire because they're not playing the game right. And so every time a natural disaster would happen, every time there was an earthquake somewhere, every time there was a flood somewhere, every time something would happen, in a world that looked for supernatural causes to such things, it was always the Christian's fault. In fact, the first time of many that this happens is the classic story of that crazy man Nero. I mean, there's not been a handful of rulers in all of world history as certifiably insane as Nero. He had decided that he wanted to tear down an old part of Rome and build it up as a monument to himself. And the government refused to give him the funds to do this pet project of his. So he used his lackeys to set fires on a particular night throughout that section of Rome. And the legend is that he stood in his garden and played the violin while that section of Rome burned all around him. Well, his idea was, as soon as that is burned down, they won't have any choice but to fund a rebuilding of that part of Rome, and I'll have this glorious monument to my memory for all time. But there's got to be a scapegoat. Well, who's handy? Well, those pesky Christians. Why were they such an easy target? Because they were typically not represented by any influential people. They weren't in the ruling classes. They weren't, by and large, in the wealthy classes, although we see from Scripture that there were wealthy people that had begun to follow Christ. But particularly in the capital city of Rome, Christians were mostly women and slaves. It's their fault. This is a natural disaster brought on by the disloyalty of these followers of the way, as they were called. These were the original recipients of the book of Revelation. They were outsiders. They were spat upon, looked down upon, rejected. The book of Revelation was for them the clearest reminder that they could be given that every single challenge they faced was okay because they were going to win. And the Jesus who left his inner circle of disciples and disappeared into the clouds, he's going to come back the same way. And they really didn't care. Well, let me rephrase that. If you had told them it's not going to be for couple of centuries, that wouldn't have compromised the core encouragement of this book. And that was, fight the good fight. Because what we do in the name of Christ is not lost. God has history already mapped out. He will unfold it according to His plan and His will and His purpose. And we are a part of that. Regardless of what the media tells us in 2015, we are on the right side of history. And that will be proven in eternity. Look at the conditions in Rome. I mentioned conquest and commerce. In the first century, really, I say by the end of the third century and into the fourth century, we really start to see Rome begin to decline. And by the fifth century, it's a shadow of what it once was. But in the first century, when the New Testament was written, Rome was at its zenith. From Emperor Augustus all the way, Augustus was the emperor when Jesus was born, all the way to Emperor Domitian at the end of the first century, the emperor until about something like 105 A.D., Rome spread from the British Isles all the way to North Africa, from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Euphrates River. Literally, Rome was the entire world. They built a highway system that created transport possibilities for a military. They were able to move their armies at a faster pace than any nation in the history of mankind. Part of what allowed them to conquer the world. I mean, literally, the Roman army marched off the map. And every time they got past the edge of the map, they would extend the map, find out who lived there, and conquer them, and add it to the empire. They built roads so that they could move their army quickly. In fact, to this day, the reason our cars, our automobiles, are the size they are is because the size of the lanes that we use are equivalent to the width of roads in the ancient Roman Empire, because they were just wide enough for the wagons and the chariots that they used in their military. I mean, that's to this day, that determines everything for us. We're still operating off of their function. And this is the thing I can't get. They surface our roads, and by the end of the winter, they have to do it again. There are 2,000-year-old Roman roads that are still functioning and doing just fine. We have this idea that we're all technologically advanced, but we need to go back and figure out what they were doing. They knew how to build highways. Not only did they build them for military transport, but these roads became trade routes. The Roman Empire was an advanced civilization partly because you could go from the British Isles in the far west all the way to Constantinople in the east, and you could trade and carry products back and forth. I mean, it was remarkable. In fact, it was the decline of the empire that eventually takes us to about the 8th century, where we have what we call the start of the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages has been described, the Middle Ages in Europe has been described as 1,000 years without a bath. Because what happened was, there has not been this sort of successive increase over 2,000 years until you get to us. We went from the pinnacle of Rome down to an existence where human beings were more like animals. In fact, we tended to live in the house with the animals. That's why the Black Plague killed 40% of Europe more than once, because our sanitation was so pathetic. I mean, it was 1,000 years after the Roman Empire before we even began to approach their culture. Part of what made the timing of the gospel so perfect is because when Jesus came, what Paul says in the book of Galatians, he says that Jesus came in what he calls the fullness of time, meaning there was at just the right moment where all of human history came to a single point that was precisely the moment for God to break in. In that moment, there were some strands that came together. For example, the Roman Empire. I mean, they're the bad guys, but they had what was called the Pax Romana. That is, in the first century, more than any century for 1,000 years, you could travel the known world in relative safety. Because you had highways to travel on, you had Roman outposts that guarded travelers and kept them safe in most places from burglars and highwaymen. The Pax Romana allowed Paul and the other carriers of the gospel to have basically unfettered access across the empire with the good news of Jesus. Secondly, not just the Pax Romana and this highway system, but the Roman Empire itself had been conquered in a sense by Greek culture, the remnants of Alexander the Great, and while Greek politics had disappeared, the language was universal. Much like English is today, everybody in the ancient world knew Greek because it was the language of commerce. It's the language you had to know to do business. You might have a first language, but you knew Greek if you were going to be involved. So the gospel could be recorded in Greek and put down on paper, and it could circulate in ways that had never happened before. I mean, historically speaking, the church came to existence at this sovereignly arranged moment in time. I listed some verses there, Revelation 18, 11 through 14. In those verses, there are over 30 articles of trade mentioned. Things that came from Spain and the Red Sea area, from Tyre and North Africa, Central Africa, India, East Asia, Arabia, Egypt, Gaul, and all of Western Europe. What we see here is this was a unique moment for the gospel. And believers in that unique moment, they had to see that Rome was God's sovereign choice for the timing of the good news. But revelation was given because they also had to see that for all of the amazing accomplishments of the culture of the Roman Empire, Rome doesn't win. You see, it would be easy living in that day and contemplating the vast achievements of this culture that no culture in history had ever aspired to. It would be easy to say, you know, I mean, this is Rome after all. What the book of Revelation told those first century believers was there's going to come a day, and you might find it hard to believe, but there's going to come a day when there are going to be Christian churches on every corner in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but Rome is going to be something we only know about from tourist brochures and history books. That's the message of the book of Revelation. Moral depravity. Both the extravagance of their wealth and the depravity of their behavior characterize this era in Rome. In fact, I've listed Romans chapter 1 as a reference there. I don't know when the last time was you read Romans chapter 1, but it is so explicit about the practices that had become commonplace in Rome that, frankly, reading Romans chapter 1 out loud in church makes us a little uncomfortable. I mean, it's just that unseemly. We have here a strategy that we call the men of Issachar. If you're in a men of Issachar reading group, you know what I'm about to say. We read 10 books a year, one each month for the first 10 months of the year, and we discuss them. And it's designed for us to have a sense of what's happening in our generation, what God is up to, how current events fit into the plan of God as best we can understand. And it gives us a sense of how we're to act as men. Men in our families, in our homes, in our churches, in our workplaces. Well, the book that we're reading right now, today is September the 2nd. And the September book is a book entitled When the Wicked Sees a City. And it is a breathtaking account of a pastor and his family who in the 1970s moved to San Francisco, California to pastor an Orthodox Presbyterian church. And he details over a 20-year span how the homosexual movement took over city government, took over the public school system, took over the public health system, and he details the attacks and the oppression. We have absolutely bought a lie. This whole idea, it breaks my heart when I see Christians look at this whole controversy that we've had in recent months about same-sex marriage, and we get all doughy-eyed and we go, but it's not right for people to not be able to marry whoever they love. Read this book and see that the agenda has never been about marriage. It's always been about the elimination of any societal boundary on human behavior whatsoever. We are becoming Rome from the year 100. And in the same way that Rome crumbled from the hollowness and the rottenness in its core, that is absolutely what's going to take us out. Well, the Iranians are going to attack us. Well, ISIS is going to come after us. Well, Russia and China. Folks, when Russia and China arrive, there's not going to be anybody left standing. Unless God does something. False religions. Religions in Rome were marked by a mixture of fear and superstition and ceremony. Emperor worship was enforced by government officials who were called consilia. Interestingly enough, the officials who enforced the worship of the emperor, that name came to be used as a level of leadership in the Catholic Church. And it also became a term of leadership in the mafia. Make of that what you will. Christians were beheaded. They were exiled. Their property was confiscated and they were reduced to poverty. Well, what are the truths that we're going to get out of this book? Well, first of all, there is the majesty of God and the centrality of Jesus. We're several weeks away, but when we get to Revelation chapters 4 and 5, you're going to see some of the most extraordinary and glorious writing ever put to paper in the history of mankind. Because John records the worship that happens around the throne room of heaven. And it paints a picture. It gives us a glimpse of Isaiah 6. You remember the scene when Isaiah, in the year that King Uzziah died, he was mourning and grieving over the loss of that king that he was close to. And he says, "I saw the Lord. He was high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple." Isaiah, 800 years before Jesus, is trying to tell us what John was telling us two generations after Jesus. And it was, if you can just grasp for a moment the reality of that space in the presence of God, it changes everything. I had a conversation this week with a church member, one of our church members, who came to me and with a little bit of reservation said, "I need to tell you something that happened to me." So, okay. And he said, "I was depressed about this and this and this," and he kind of outlined some things that he was struggling with. And he said, I was on the Broken Arrow Expressway, and I was driving my car, and he said, "This has been months ago, and I just now have the courage to tell you." And he said, "I'm just sad, because things didn't turn out, and I wanted to do this, but I couldn't, and my health wouldn't let me do this, and I was limited, and I was just driving down the road." And he said, "Jesus just showed up in my car." He said it wasn't like he was sitting in the seat, but I just knew that he just made himself known to me. And he said, I don't know how he said it to me. I can't say that I heard it or that I thought it. I just knew. He called me by name and said, "Don't worry about those things. You're mine. And that's all that matters." And he said, "Pastor, in that moment, I didn't have any ambition in my life except to just follow Jesus. I just want to be in His presence every minute." Folks, that's an amazing gift. Doesn't always happen to us. But what that was a taste of the peace and the contentment and the wholeness and the health and the satisfaction that will be our every moment experience in the presence of Jesus in eternity. You see, as we look at the book of Revelation, it paints a picture for us that whatever we go through here, it's worth it. Whatever we're called to, it's worth it. Whatever sacrifice is required of us, it's worth it. The reality and power of evil. While God is majestic and Christ is central, we live in a generation that refuses to acknowledge that evil even exists. We think that people just do bad things because they have bad cultural influences. Fact of the matter is, people do bad things because people are bad. It's not just external influences, but the message of Revelation has a two-edged sword for us. And while the reality is that evil is about personal choices, Revelation tells us that evil does infiltrate the structures of society as well. The forces of evil are embodied in institutions. That means we never give our ultimate loyalty to the government. We do fight against human trafficking. We do stand against abortion. We do defend marriage because the structures themselves have taken on the influence of evil. Revelation will tell us about Antichrist. That is the power of evil at work in the process of history, but finally and completely embodied in a person. The church has a role to play in all of this, and it is to protest any system of idealized society. We have got to quit voting for politicians who tell us they have the answers that will make us live in a utopia. That will not happen. It's wrong to limit salvation to individual decisions, but it's also wrong for us to just focus on that with no sense of the pursuit of peace and justice and reconciliation. We are not just as a church to survive in the last days, but even in the days of the Antichrist, we are to do battle. Because evil is real, but we win. Revelation tells us to engage in the battle because the victory is ours. History is not cyclical, as so many other world religions argue. It doesn't keep coming around. It is linear. It is meaningful. It is headed toward a particular conclusion. Revelation is filled with emphases on worship, on judgment, and it calls us to political and social action. That is justice, care for the helpless, rejection of the abuses of power. You know, it's easy to be cynical in our political structure. But we've got to get past this business. You know, we see politicians lie to us all the time. They get caught sending naked pictures of themselves by text messages, and they get caught lying over here, and they cheat over here, and they break the rules over here. And we just sort of shrug and we go, well, you know, what are you going to do? That's politics. We got to quit shrugging that off. We have to regain a sense of outrage that people who stand in a delegated role of authority, delegated from God, they should be held to a standard. Is it too much to ask them to just follow the basic rules of civilization? Well, you know, they're politicians. What are you gonna do? I'm gonna do my best, dead level best to get them out of office. And frankly, I'm beginning to care less and less what party they're a part of. Revelation tells us that bottom line again is that the kingdom wins. That's the supreme contribution of this book. The guarantee that enables every believer in every generation to move forward in faith and hope. Well, I was going to do verses 4 through 8 of the first chapter. Excuse me. Let me just read these verses. We read the first three verses. I told you that prologue is really some of my favorite verses in the whole Bible. But John gives us really his personal introduction in verse 4. John, to the seven churches in Asia, grace and peace to you from the one who is, who was, and who is coming, from the seven spirits before his throne, and from Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth. To him who loves us and has set us free from our sins by his blood, and made us a kingdom, priests to his God and Father, the glory and dominion are his forever and ever. Amen. Look! He's coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, including those who pierced him, and all the families of the earth will mourn over him. This is certain. Amen. I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, the one who is, who was, and who is coming, the Almighty. Wow. He starts with greetings from the triune God. He says right there, he speaks about God who is the eternal communicated in a temporal way. That is, God made himself known. We would never know God if he hadn't revealed himself. There's no way we could discover him rationally. He has revealed himself. The Spirit is the perfect completion of this Trinity. He comes with a special message for these churches. Jesus, it says here that he's a witness. It's the Greek word that translates into martyr. The model of faithfulness, even unto death. He taught us how to live, but he taught us how to die as well. The Trinity is it's a hefty subject. St. Augustine, great theologian of the ancient church, he said, contemplating the doctrine of the Trinity reminded him of a little child who was trying to empty the ocean by filling his bucket and pouring it out on the beach. We've just finished a book on our church staff by Timothy Keller, entitled The Reason for God. In one of the closing chapters, he speaks about the Trinity. And I love this. He doesn't explain the Trinity. There's no real way to get your mind wrapped around this whole three persons in one. But he describes the Trinity as a dance. In effect, each person of the Trinity forever giving himself completely to the other two persons of the Trinity. Kind of a perpetual interaction of love. He makes the argument that if God was simply a unity, a single being, then he couldn't be characterized by love in his essence, because love would be impossible until after he had created someone to be in relationship with. But because God is the Trinity, and he has always been in that intertwined interaction, that dance within himself, love flowing from relationship and mutual affection, it flows to us out of the very essence of who he is. A God who was not Trinity could be a God of justice or a God of creation or a God of lots of different things, but he couldn't be a God of love. Revelation reminds us that while the justice of God is put on display throughout the book of Revelation, his justice is an aspect of what it means that he's a God of love. That throws people off. Well, how can he be a God of love and a God of justice? The better question is, how could he be a God of love without being a God of justice? That's Revelation. These verses, we won't go over them. They are a doxology of praise. He describes us as priests. He affirms that Christ is going to return. Really, verse 7 is kind of the thesis statement of the entire book. Look, he's coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, including those who pierced him. Think about that. John, recording these words for the first time, he was in that semicircle, standing there on that hilltop, trying to follow the outline of Jesus as he kind of glistened into the clouds, and eventually they lost sight of him. You don't think John looked up into the sky every single day of his life? Every time a cloud passed? For us, we see dogs and butterflies, and John looked at every cloud in the sky as a potential portal to see the one that he loved more than anybody else in the world. Look, he's coming back on the clouds, and even those who pierced him will see him and acknowledge him. He came the first time as a baby in a manger, born in a stable. There is no hidden identity next time. No superhero secret identity. When he comes back, he will be known by everybody on the planet. Every tongue will confess. Every knee will bow that Jesus Christ is Lord. There's no secret return taught in the book of Revelation. He's not going to slip in under cover of darkness and steal the church away. When he comes, CNN will be unnecessary, because he will be recognized as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Father, thank you for your word. This time in Revelation, Father, let it encourage us, let it compel us, let it move us into the fullness of what you expect of us, what you have for us. We are so tired of being a part of a church in a generation that just goes with the flow. We want to be the full-blooded people of God. Use these teachings in your holy word to bring us precisely where you want us to be, so that we will be good and faithful servants in every respect as we serve the Alpha and the Omega, the one who will come in the clouds. Even so, Lord Jesus, come. Amen.